Gordon Teal, even a stick could preach after singing like that. We're thankful that you can be here to enjoy it with us. It's one of the most outstanding things, I believe, of this congregation, and you're it, but you're what causes it, and Christ's Spirit in you promoting it. We've been studying for the last several Sunday nights glimpses of the life of Christ as we draw from all four gospel accounts material that is related as it explains and elaborates on certain facets of the life of Jesus. We've talked about him as being Jesus, the great teacher, the storyteller, and then Jesus, the Jesus, the mixer. Jesus, the mixer, and Jesus, the great physician. And we noticed his healings, and Jesus, the logician, last Sunday night that I was here. Tonight, we're going to be studying about another aspect of his life that I believe is important. We're going to talk tonight about Jesus the rebel. It was Monday morning, early, the second day of the Passover feast in A.D. 29, about 4 days before Jesus was betrayed and crucified. It was early in the morning. The scene is the temple courtyard. The principal character is this Galilean carpenter. And his hands, no doubt sun-tanned, he takes some thongs of leather and makes a whip similar to what men who deal in cattle would use for driving cattle. And he takes those thongs and weaves it into a whip. And that's the setting that we're going to be noticing tonight as the introduction. But first, let me just bring to your attention the scene that took place the day prior to that. On the first day of that Passover week, A.D. 29, Jesus had entered into the city of Jerusalem with his disciples. He had sent them ahead to find a donkey and told them where to go, and they brought the donkey back, and he sat upon it. They put their garments on the donkey. Jesus sat there and then went into the city of Jerusalem in what has become known since then as the triumphal entry. It was nothing more nor less in the eyes of the rulers of those people as a rebellion. It was an odd rebellion, though. The man didn't come on a horse. He came on a donkey, the foal of an ass. And he didn't come with swords and spears. He came with something that they couldn't cope with. But nevertheless, he was viewed by these people as an insurrectionist. He was viewed by the rulers of the Jews as a rebel. And they rebuked him and said, "Why don't you stop these people from saying that you're the son of David?" And he said, "I'll tell you what, if you do stop them, the rocks are going to cry out." And so he went on into the city of Jerusalem, having wept over it as he went into the city, stopping the train and sitting there on the donkey weeping over the rebellion of those people. And then he went on into the city, accomplishing the great prophecy about his coming into Zion upon an ass and meek. And it's strange that immediately after he entered the city of Jerusalem in a posture of meekness upon an ass, Mark says he went into the temple and looked around, but because it was late, he left and went on back out to Bethany, probably to the home of Mary and Martha and Lazarus. He was spending the nights out there on this last week and was coming back and forth into the temple. He would arrive in the temple early in the morning. But he went on back out to Bethany that night on Sunday evening. Early Monday morning, he arose and came with his disciples back toward the city of Jerusalem. In what later can be seen as a preview of what he was about to do, he came upon a fig tree that had leaves but no fruit. He went to the tree because it was all leafed out, evidently prematurely, looking for fruit because he was hungry. He found no fruit upon it and cursed it, said, "No fruit shall ever be found upon you from henceforth." He went on into the city and went into the temple. And it was then that he made this whip, and the scene begins. The semblance, or the symbolic nature of the cursing of the fig tree, incidentally, let me make that, because I'll probably not remember to say it again. He came to Jerusalem looking for the fruits of Jerusalem, of the people of God. He had come to them for 3.5 years as in his physical body, as Jesus of Nazareth, looking for the fruits of righteousness. And having looked upon that tree of Jerusalem and of the people of Israel, of God, and not having found any fruit upon it, he also was bringing upon them a curse. He said they would not be left without one, one stone would not be left upon another. And he, in that pronouncement of the curse that was about to come upon these people, it was almost identical to the curse that he placed upon the barren fig tree. But he went on into the temple, made the whip, and began then what we know of as the cleansing of the temple. A wild scene it must have been. I'm confident that they were totally shocked. They were taken back. They didn't know what to think about it. Tables began to be knocked here and there. Chairs were turned over. Money changers' drawers were thrown up. The coins were running at every direction across the polished marble. And cattle were being released. Birds were being knocked over. Chairs of those who were selling the doves or the pigeons, Mark says, were knocked over. And the people who were buying and selling, Mark says, both the buyers and the sellers, were driven out of the temple with a forcefulness, no doubt, that startled the people. And those who write of those days say that the flute players and the choir of the Levite tribe that stood there in this colossade or this palisade, they were shocked, no doubt, to silence as this intruder came and began approaching and attacking the very hub of the finances of the Hebrew nation. You see, this particular scene, this particular activity, the buying and selling of animals for sacrifice, was under the direct control of the Romans. It was under their supervision, and it was under the direct control, I guess you'd say, of the collaborationist Sadducean regime. They were in charge of the high priesthood. They were the ones who parceled out these plums to the people who bought these offices of power in the Jewish nation. And with these offices of power that had been bought by the Sadducees, and they were in control at that time, they, in collaboration with the Roman government, were busily engaged in milking the Jewish nation of people for everything they could get. And while the poorer priests, who were not in positions of power, were starving, the rich aristocracy of the Sadducees were rolling in money, and the Roman coffers were being filled with the tax money and the sacrificial money and the exchange money that was being taken from the Jewish people. Jesus lashed out against it. No doubt in the castle of Antonia, in the towers there, there were Roman sentries watching this scene. And no doubt they were waiting on announcements or waiting on some order from their superiors to tell them, go down and stop this man. But nobody ever stopped him. He came in there with an authority that they had no control over. And I don't doubt that the decisiveness of his action was such that they knew that he meant business, and that they knew that he had a right to do what he was doing. And so it was that he drove them out of there. And Mark even indicates that Jesus temporarily controlled the entire area. But the entire area of the courtyard was 1/2 mile in circumference. How can one man control the busy commerce of an entire 1/2 mile circumference in a busy courtyard like the temple courtyard in the city of Jerusalem? Maybe his disciples helped. I don't know. The Bible doesn't say. It just says that he would not allow anyone to carry anything through there. Now that's what Mark says about it. Jesus would not allow anybody to carry anything through that temple. Jesus was known as a rebel. What was the cause of his rebellious action? Do you know? Tonight, I'm going to notice with you just about 4 events. There are more than that, more events than that, but I'm going to notice with you four categories, and I want you to see why it was Jesus rebelled. These events are pretty well, they're interesting, all of them are, but they don't really mean a lot unless we can gather a lesson from it. Why did Jesus rebel at this occasion here? Well, for this simple reason, and this is number one, God was being deprived of his honor. And people were being deprived of their rights and of their needs. And whenever that happened, whenever God was being deprived of his honor and people were being deprived of their rights and their needs, Jesus rebelled. You can always count on it. And so it was here. Jesus said to them, "Is it not written? My Father's house should be called a house of prayer for all the nations, but you've made it a den for robbers." And so he lashed out at them with strong language. And let them know that whenever they, by their ridiculous actions, would dare to rob God of his honor or to bring such reproach upon the people that they would deprive them of their needs and of their rights, Jesus said, "You've got me to answer to." And he drove them out of there with no questions asked. He just let them have it. And they went flying. They didn't argue with him. And no one stopped him. No one arrested him. They later had the gall to come up and say, "By what authority do you do this?" And he said, "Well, I'll ask you a question too. If you answer me, then I'll answer you. The baptism of John, was it from heaven or from men?" And they got in an argument among themselves. And they said, "Well, we don't know." He said, "Neither am I going to tell you by what authority I do this." Oh, you're serving quite a man, I'll tell you. He was no lily white, someone who was perfumed and in king's palaces. He was no someone who never was riled because of indignities and indecencies and injustices. Not this man. This man was strong. He had done carpentry work for 30 years until he was 30 years old. No doubt he was sinewy. No doubt he was muscular. No doubt his hands were calloused. He had been with rough fishermen, people who today would have been truck drivers, as Russ Dudry calls them. He went around with people like that. This was the Jesus you're serving. This was one of the aspects of his life. Oh, and listen, he used language that, you judge for yourself. He called people blind guides, fools, hypocrites, liars, sons of the devil, a pit of snakes. How shall you escape the judgment of hell? Very colorful. Jesus was regarded by the people as a rebel. But there were other occasions other than the cleansing of the temple. And he clashed on many other occasions with the rulers of the Jewish people. It's interesting to note that he'd never clashed with the Roman officials. It's interesting to notice that he never gave them the time of day except to be kind to them and to tell the people, I'm forgetting now what he did tell them, but he just indicated that they weren't to rebel against the Roman government. But his ire was raised and his rebuke was brought forth against the ruling people who were supposed to be the religious rulers. That's where he directed his attack. And so it was, that's where the conflict arose. And that's where the accusation arose that he was a subversive. It was in reference to the Jewish nation, not in reference to the Roman government. Though they used this as a cover-up, they said, "This man claims to be king, and any man who makes himself a king is an enemy of Caesar." But Jesus wasn't in competition with Caesar. He was in competition with the abuse that the Jewish leaders were engaged in of the law of God. Notice again a second thing that happened. He was in constant conflict with them on the Sabbath day. The Sabbath question. On numerous occasions, Jesus was in serious disagreement between himself and the Jews. Six instances occur where Jesus was in opposition and was standing as a rebel in the eyes of these people because of his attitude toward the Sabbath and his actions on the Sabbath. This was not something that he did in ignorance. There are these six occasions. I don't know whether you're familiar with them all or not. For time's sake, I thought I wouldn't tell all of them, but probably by the time I'd ask you to raise your hand, if you're not familiar with it, it would take all the time that we would ordinarily spend in just telling the story. But let me ask you, please, if you will, just turn with me in your Bibles to Matthew 9. I'm going to flip to these six instances in his life. following two of these, it says they went out and tried, they took counsel how to destroy him. They were trying to kill him. On all six, we find that Jesus could have postponed what he did until sundown. None of these were of such a tragic or a drastic nature that it had to be taken care of right then. Nobody was drowning. Nobody was literally dying. There was no one actually in the ditch. He could have waited till the sun went down, but he chose to do otherwise. Why? And may I say this, that when Jesus Christ stood up against the Jewish concept of the Sabbath, he was actually attacking their very national image. And he did it anyway. In Matthew the 12th chapter, the plucking of the grain on the Sabbath. Matthew 12, his disciples went through the grain field, verses 1 through about 8. Went through the grain field. We don't know what time of day it was, but it was on the Sabbath. And they began to pluck the grain, rub the grain, blow off the husk, and to eat that as their sustenance for the day. Instead of taking the side of their accusers, when their accusers came to Jesus and said, "Look, your disciples are breaking the law," Jesus said, "Have you never read what David did when he was in the, and ate the showbread?" And he said, "Anyway, if you had known what this meant, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you wouldn't have condemned the guiltless. The Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath." And he whipped right back at those accusers and said, "You mustn't condemn those who are not guilty. You don't know what you're talking about. God is the God of mercy, not sacrifice." All right, look again in Matthew 12, the next verse. Verse 9, "There was a man, he went on from there and entered their synagogue, and behold, there was a man with a withered hand. And he asked him, and they asked him, 'Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath?' So that they might accuse him. And then he showed them how inconsistent they were. He said, 'What man of you having a sheep, if it falls into the pit on the Sabbath day, will not lift it out? How much more value then is a man than a sheep?'" To ask the question is to answer it. And he could look right at him and say, "Of how much more value is a man than a sheep? You will lift your sheep out on the Sabbath. I choose to lift a man out on the Sabbath. Now tell me which one is better." Look again in Luke, the 13th chapter, is a third incident. Luke 13, 10 through 16. Oh, this poor soul. This woman had been, she had had a spirit of infirmity for 18 years. She was bent over and couldn't fully straighten herself. Jesus saw her, called her to him and said, "Woman, you're freed from your infirmity." Verse 13 says, "And he laid his hands upon her, and immediately she was made straight, and she praised God." Don't you know she was relieved? But don't you know also that she could have waited one more day? Jesus didn't have to heal her on the Sabbath. He could have waited until the sun went down, and it wouldn't have been but a matter of hours. One, two, or three, 4 hours in contrast or comparison to 18 years, it wouldn't have mattered. Why didn't he wait? Why was he such a rebellious person? Why did he so stand up in the face of the Jewish traditions and all? Well, was there a reason? Look at Luke 14, the first 6 verses. He was going home one day after being in the synagogue, and this was just like going home after church. He went home one day with one of the Pharisees, and there was a man there, and where they ate, and as they ate, it was kind of semi-private and semi-public. People could come in and watch and go on about their way. It was they had these meals in kind of a courtyard, and people were just kind of saying in and out, and there was a man there that had dropsy. I always thought dropsy was he was dropped over. Bill, correct me, dropsy, I looked it up in the dictionary. Dropsy is the accumulation of fluids in the body, in various parts of the body that cause trouble, all right? And I'll bet you didn't know that. I didn't know that till today. Dropsy is the accumulation of fluids. Maybe a pleurisy. Is pleurisy dropsy? It's not. Okay, let me get out of there. This man had dropsy, and we'll leave it at that. But here again, he had it, I don't know how long. He could have waited a day. But anyway, we find that this was done by Jesus. He healed him on the Sabbath day in the presence of all these Pharisees. Turn over to John, the 5th chapter, and 5 through 16. John 5, 5 through 16. The healing of the man that had been sick for 38 years. Oh, that's such a touching occasion. He was at the Pool of Bethesda. He couldn't get out in there. Jesus said, "Sir, would you be made well?" And he began to kind of whine. He said, "Well, sir, every time I try, somebody else gets down in the water before me." There was a tradition among the Jews of healing properties of this pool. Every time, evidently, it was some kind of a gurgling pool, and every time it would bubble, they attributed that to an angel stirring it, and they had this tradition that whoever got in there first could be healed. And he said, "I'm not fast enough. Somebody's always getting down there ahead of me." And then Jesus healed the man, but it was on the Sabbath day. He could have done it a different day. The man had been there for 38 years. What was so rushing about it? There wasn't anything rushing. But Jesus healed him on the Sabbath day anyway. And then John, the 9th chapter, verses 14 through 16, we find him healing the man born blind. Look, the man's entire life had been spent in darkness. Why go up against the customs of the Jews by healing him on the Sabbath day? Jesus, because of his persistent abuse or his persistent going in the face of the traditions of the Jews about the Sabbath, was regarded as a persistent and intentional opponent of their religion. There was no part of their religion that would be so such an offense to them as the abuse or the breaking what they thought of the Sabbath day. There was no other part of their religion that would so identify themselves and others with that religion as the Sabbath day. And Jesus was more times probably on this occasion or on this in this sort of a situation or surroundings, more times than any other time, he found himself in opposition to the Jews. Now, why? Well, for one reason, and for this is really the only reason, Jesus rebelled at the way they were keeping the Sabbath because they were taking a law from God that had been given to show the mercy of God and were twisting that and making it an instrument of oppression. They were taking, and I could get Russ to come up and start to do it, to just tell us all the things. We wouldn't have time. We'd have to stay for weeks for him or anybody else who knows about it to tell us all the offenses and all the things, that the oppression rather, that the Jewish leaders heaped upon the Jewish people. Not combing their hair for fear they'd find a gray hair. Not eating eggs late on the Sabbath. Not collecting rent, but being able to receive rent. Not going but 7/8 of a mile, putting something down that would make that your homestead. Going 7/8 more, putting down another shoe. Oh. And Jesus looked at all of that. And then if you'll go back into Deuteronomy, the 5th chapter, and see what the purpose of the law of the Sabbath was, you'll find that God connected the law of the Sabbath with the Jewish nation, with their being in Egyptian bondage, where they worked 7 days a week, probably about 16 hours a day. They worked and worked and worked. And God, when he called them up out of Egypt, said, "You remember, you were a slave in Egypt once, and 6 days only shall you work. You're not going to work on the Sabbath, nor are you going to let those who work for you work on the Sabbath, nor are you going to let those who are the working animals, you're not going to have your oxen or your ass or any of these, they're not going to work on the Sabbath day either. There'll be a cessation of work. Everybody deserves a day off." My, what a difference there was between that and what the Jews were perpetrating and saying was the intention of the law. You see, at the very cornerstone of Jesus' revelation of God to people, at the very cornerstone was this great, magnificent, cardinal truth. God is a God of mercy. God is a God of mercy, not sacrifice like you're making people. He said, "Look, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath." The Jews had become such legalists that they were interpreting it as though God looked around for something to put on man that would make a burden upon him. Jesus said, "You've got it backwards. The Sabbath was made and applied to the human race through the Jews, or for the Jews, as an instrument of mercy, not something to make them more heavily burdened." Consequently, wherever Jesus found men taking laws of God that were intended to show God as a God of mercy, and those people then using those laws as instruments of a burden or instruments of insensitiveness, or there's a word that of hardship, instruments of hardship, then Jesus just simply rebelled. He said, "You're not going to do like that." And he says, "I'm here to see to it." Now watch, he wasn't in opposition to the law. What he was in opposition was to the traditions that had been heaped upon the law and that had encrusted themselves around the law to where the people couldn't even be blessed by the law. Oh my. Jesus said, "You're not going to get by with that as long as I'm here. And I'm here to tell you that I'm here to break up all such misrepresentations of God as that." Well, there was another occasion, and that is regarding ceremonial washings. There are two events that alone, there are two that are parallel in Matthew 15. And turn to Mark 7 if you want to turn to one, the first 23 verses. And then there's one in Luke 11. The one in Mark 7 had to do with Jesus' own disciples. Some of them weren't washing before they ate. Now, that didn't mean they didn't wash their hands and get the dirt off. It meant that they were not going through the ceremonial washings that were prescribed and were allowed. You know, they allowed the water to, I think, drip off their hands, and they had to do it in such a way that we use today, I think, the same methods as far in the hospitals in order to go and make sure that they're hygienically clean. And the Jews had so perfected this thing that they just had it down to the gnat's eyebrow, you know, and they were going to do it, and everybody had to do this before they ate. Well, Jesus didn't go along with that. He said, for one thing, look, it's not what goes in the man that defiles him, it's what comes out of him. Oh, but it offended them. After he corrected the Pharisees on this, his disciples came to him and said, do you realize that you offended the Pharisees when you said this? He said, let them alone. They're blind guides. If the blind guide the blind, they're both going to fall in the ditch. He said, let them alone. What plants my heavenly Father's not planted will be rooted up. He said, they're blind guides. Just let them alone. Well, now, why did he do that? His disciples were not washing ceremonially. Why did he not do that? Why was he so determined to break this tradition? It was one that was a very serious one with them. They would not eat. They just simply would not. When they came in from the market or came in from association with people, they would not eat unless they had this ceremonial washing. Jesus said, no longer. Was he against ceremonies? No. Was he against being separate from the world? No, that's not what he was against. He was certainly for that. But if you look in the context in Mark the 9th or the 7th chapter, you'll find that Jesus was saying, look, what you need to be concerned with is not so much external cleanliness, it's internal cleanliness. And what's really important is service from the heart rather than service outside the person. That's not what's really important. He said what's really important is heart service rather than lip service. Oh, when they accused him, rather than being ashamed and saying to his disciples, now you ought to go ahead and wash, he said, well did Isaiah speak of you, you hypocrites? And then he quoted from Isaiah where Isaiah said, this people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching as their doctrines the commandments of men. And then he gave them an example of how that their external cleanliness was just a cover-up for their own hypocrisy or for their own iniquity. And they were actually hypocritical in their washings. He said, for example, the law of Moses says you shall honor your father and mother. And he who speaks a word against his father and mother, he'll be stoned. But you say, wherein you would have been benefited by me, talking to their old mother or daddy. When Jesus was talking about honoring his father and mother, they knew what it meant. Jesus knew what it meant. It meant take care of them when they were old, as well as being respectful to them when you're young and when they're young. When they get old, somebody's got to take care of them. Jesus said, Moses said, you must take care of your mother and father. But he said, you say, if you say to your mother or father, that wherewith you would have been benefited from me is Corban. In other words, I have given it to the temple. I've turned over all of my assets and all of my possessions to the temple service. And they say, you excuse yourselves from even taking care of your mother and father. So by your traditions, you have actually violated the word of God. He said, you have a fine way of doing this. Mark has a very colorful way of saying it. He said to them, after he said, you draw near to me with your lips, but your heart is far from me. Mark said, Jesus then spoke to them and said, you have a fine way of rejecting the commandment of God in order to keep your tradition. So we find this man becoming a rebel. And simply saying, you're not going to do like that. You're not going to use external symbols and external services and ceremonies to cover up your iniquities and the way that you're acting. You're not going to do that. And so he just went down the row and just taking off whatever was holding back the real connotation of what they were doing. He says, you're not going to be hypocritical like that. It's all going to be made light. And he began just to do it. In Luke, the 11th chapter, he himself was accused of not washing. And he said, you fools. And listen, Jesus could call a man a fool, and when he called him a fool, you knew he was a fool. You and I can't call people fools. You can't see into their hearts. But he said, you foolish people, you fools. Did he who make the outside not make the inside also? But give for alms those things which are within, and behold, everything is clean for you. So here again, he was just simply saying, don't get so caught up in religion that you think that the external outweighs the internal. It doesn't. He said, you better start with the inside first and then clean it up. And then if you'll give from within, everything will be clean. There won't be anything outside you that's unclean if you'll just clean up your hearts first. And so Christ, at the very, very center of his whole revelation, was the heart. And whenever he found religion that was so callous to the nature of God that they would heap upon themselves external ceremonies that not only beclouded the heart, but actually excluded the heart from religion, Jesus said, you're not going to do that as long as I'm around. I'm not going to have any part of it. And so he was a rebel. When it came to so misappropriating and abusing religion to where it was a matter of externals rather than internals. Finally, Jesus met with opposition to the Jewish people because of his association with sinners. Oh, how he got in trouble. He was forever getting in trouble over eating with somebody who was a sinner. Oh, and you could always see them going. I just picture the real, you know, the up and ends as he was with the down and outs, and the up and ends would say, he's eating with sinners. Look, that man's eating with a Pharisee and a sinner, with a tax collector and a sinner. And they were forever getting after him about it. They asked his disciples, you know, they wouldn't talk to Jesus on some of these occasions. They said, why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners? Jesus, overhearing it, said, go and learn what this means. I desire mercy and not sacrifice. And he said, after all, it's the sick who have need of a doctor, not the well. Ooh. How do you argue with that? They just go off in a huff, you know, try to go out, just go take counsel with somebody. Well, let's just kill him. We can't put him in a pigeonhole. Let's just kill him. And when he chose Matthew Levi threw this great feast. We've already studied about it. And all these cronies of his, the tax collectors and the sinners and the people of the street and all, they just crowded in there and they had a great time. In Luke, the 7th chapter, there was this woman who came in while they were eating in Simon the Pharisee's house. She was a prostitute, evidently, a woman of the street. You know the story, how she cried at his feet, wiping his feet with her hair. Oh, this was such a shock to Simon. He said, if this man were really a prophet, he'd know what kind of a woman and who this is that's touching him. When he went through Jericho and saw Zacchaeus, got in trouble again. About 10 days before he was crucified, he got in trouble about Zacchaeus. People were again after him because of the people that he kept company with. The woman taken in adultery, laid his neck right down with her and said, all right, in a sense, if you're going to kill her, you're going to kill me first. Let him that's without sin among you cast the first stone. Why would he be so rebellious? Why would he not go on with the respectable people and just go on and be with the respectable people and let those people go on to hell, those that are the adulterers and those that are living in ways they ought not to live, and the tax collectors and all these people? Because Jesus taught them there's more that is sin than just sin in the eyes of religious people. There are sins of attitude that are just as sinful and just as damning as is the sin of theft or adultery. And consequently, Jesus Christ rebelled whenever his association with sinners or whenever his association with anyone was so curtailed that it would not allow him to reach down and save the very people that he came to save. You see, right at the very heart of Jesus' ministry, he says, I have come to seek and save the lost. And Paul said, this is a faithful saying, that Jesus Christ came into the world to save sinners. Now, in conclusion, why did Jesus rebel? Why was he a rebel? Understand that he was not rebelling against the law. Jesus rebelled against human traditions. Whenever he saw human traditions deprive God of his honor and deprive human beings of their needs and their rights, Jesus became a rebel. Secondly, whenever he saw God's laws, such as the Sabbath law, which were designed by God to show the merciful nature of God, when he saw those laws of God being twisted in such a way as to portray God as an unmerciful and unloving God, he said, that won't work. I'll not allow that. Jesus became a rebel. And when he saw the external being elevated above the internal and were being exploited in the sense that they were being taken to cover up the corruption and all that was on the inside of the people, Jesus said, I'll not have anything to do with that. Jesus became a rebel. And when church-going sinners discriminated against non-church-going sinners, Jesus said, I'll have no part in that either. I wonder what would happen if Jesus were to come among us tonight. I wonder how he would look at us as we deal with laws as they relate to people. What are you going to do with all these adulterers? What are you going to do with all these people that have been divorced and remarried? Tell me, what will you do with them? It's a pretty big issue. Jesus had to face it. What are you going to do with laws that let God be portrayed as a God who is unmerciful and unkind? Or did Jesus not come to save people? Yes, he did. What are you going to do with Jesus when he comes and he shows that really the internal really is what's important? And we are a people who are so staunch on the external. And I'm not urging you to become less staunch on the external. What I'm simply saying is whenever Jesus would come among us, I'm convinced that he might say, oh, you people, man alive, you better start with your hearts first. What do you think Jesus would be to us? Would he be a rebel? We've got some parking lot problems out here. There's a whole bunch of sinners that meet out there about every night, right out here at this west parking lot. And they sit there and they throw their beer cans and their bottles and they break stuff and all this confetti, and it's out there. What are you going to do about it? Call the police and get them out of here. No, we better not do that. Well, the elders talked about what should they do, and they came to the conclusion, well, let's try to influence them. Let's not run them off. Oh, that's a victory. But what would Jesus? Well, he'd be out there among them, I suspect. I haven't yet gotten the nerve to do that. I'm serious. And it concerns me because I don't know that I can relate to them. They'd see this bald head and this straight, you know, this suit and all. They'd say, man, who are you? What are you doing out here? You're supposed to be grooving it, man. We're not with you. I don't know that they'd accept me. If there are any of you that can go out there and mingle with them without offending them and be with them, please do it. The elders, they're open to it and they're wanting to know how we can reach those people. But I wonder sometimes if Jesus would not come among us and really look at us as really not what God wants us to be. And he would appear to us as a rebel. Oh, look, don't ever worry about what brethren are going to say about you. Worry about what God's going to say about us. And if standing up against the traditions of the church, and there are traditions in the church today that are just as wrong and that are just as rank as those that were among the Jews of Jesus' day, don't be afraid to stand up and say, Jesus of Nazareth will have nothing to do with that. And if they kill you, well, la-ti-da, that's all they can do. Really, that's all they can do is kill you. And if they kill me, I'll just go home ahead of them. I'll go on home. Jesus the rebel, man alive, he was going to see to it that God was given his honor, that people were given their needs, that the heart was emphasized over the external, that the laws of God were so distributed and so demonstrated that it would indicate that God is after people's good, not after them to get them, and that he came to save sinners. He was out there among them where the sick folks are and know it. That's what he came to do. And he came up against a religion that had absolutely forgotten all about what true religion is. I wonder if we recognize it. Tonight, it's this kind of Lord that calls you sinners. If you're out there and you think, well, they wouldn't want to be a part of us. Yeah, Jesus would. Would you come on? Would you accept that kind of a master and that kind of a Lord? He wants you to. If you love him and if you believe in him, if you'd like to confess your faith in him today, we want you to do that. And those of us then who are already his disciples, let's let him operate on us. Let's let him bring us into conformity to his will. And let's, if necessary, be a rebel just like he was in order to get to the real heart of religion. It may cost you your life, but so what? Jesus said if you're ashamed of him, he's going to be ashamed of you. Tonight, if you need to respond for any reason at all that we can help you with in a way that's right, you come while we stand and sing.